The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 22. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing three tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Finn McCool, Nikki Exposito, and Dale Thompson. Tonight we'll hear stories of menacing matrons, awful aristocrats, and cracked cultists. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So, lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. Neighborhoods. Communities. On the one hand, they seem so quiet, so unassuming, and most of the time, people just go about their daily lives. But sometimes, there's that one house on the block nobody wants to walk past, or where people go in and never come out, or even that weird community center group that always meets well after dark, and the lights in the building keep flickering. Yes, sometimes it's not the unknown you should be worried about. It's the people you know all too well. Finn McCool brings us the first tale of the night with a dip into suburbia and what is normally a helpful thing, the neighborhood watch. The watch is there to keep everyone safe, right? Make sure nobody comes around smashing in windows and whatnot. What about that old saying, though? Who watches the watchman? Without further ado, I present to you Mrs. Jones' Neighborhood Watch. It was never my intention to get on the wrong side of Mrs. Jones from number 5. Sure, I never liked the woman. I always considered her a busybody, a village tyrant who thought she ruled over the whole neighborhood. Widow Jones had long been the head of our local homeowners association and seemed to take a perverse pleasure from imposing meaningless rules and regulations, and she generally liked to stick her nose into other people's business. Her bully-like behavior didn't sit right with me, but I'm not someone who likes confrontation, so I prefer to keep my head down and not cause problems. If I'm honest, I'd have to say I gave in way too easily to Widow Jones's petty demands, and I submitted without argument when she ordered me to move my garbage cans or mow my slightly overgrown lawn. Likewise, I would turn a blind eye whenever the woman harassed and bullied my neighbors, berating them in the middle of the street for everybody to see. I'd peek through my curtains to observe these arguments, and my blood would boil when I saw the white-haired Mrs. Jones humiliating those poor people. But I would never intervene. I told myself it wasn't my fight, and so would retreat into the warmth and safety of my comfortable suburban home, soon forgetting all about the unpleasantness. I suppose I could have continued to live like this indefinitely, but in time, the situation on my home street escalated, and Mrs. Jones transformed from a petty old woman with too much time in her hands to a dangerous tyrant with a frightening level of control over her followers. It all started last month when our normally quiet and peaceful neighborhood was subjected to several acts of minor vandalism. I'm talking about eggs thrown at windows, toilet paper left hanging from tree branches, small-scale teenage pranks that you'd expect to see from time to time. But of course, Widow Jones and her people blew the whole thing out of proportion, acting like our community was in the midst of a deadly crime wave. Before long, we were all dragged into an emergency HOA meeting, during which Mrs. Jones spoke at length about the great threat facing our community and how we had to take decisive action to protect ourselves. Her solution was a neighborhood watch scheme, a group which would, of course, be led by Mrs. Jones herself and packed with her closest supporters. This faction included the Smiths, a childless couple with multiple cats who roamed the neighborhood and had an unpleasant tendency to leave little presents on my lawn. Then there was the Colonel, an ex-military man who retained his no-nonsense persona and passion for strict discipline. The Colonel also kept a substantial collection of firearms and bladed weapons, and he was said to be very proficient in hand-to-hand combat. Finally, there was Harriet, a middle-aged spinster known for her bizarre behavior and nasty habit of spreading gossip and false rumors among the other neighbors. I could just about deal with these odd characters on a one-to-one basis, but together, under the direction of Mrs. Jones, this group were an unholy terror. I did my best to avoid their suburban vigilante gang, although I would often observe their activities from my bedroom window, watching as they patrolled our tidy street of detached two-story houses, neat green lawns, and white picket fences. And all the time, they were searching for violent criminals who simply did not exist in this place. There was something particularly sinister about this little group who'd let the little power they had go to their heads. Soon they began acting like Stasi, constantly patrolling the block and aggressively challenging anyone unfamiliar or vaguely suspicious. They always had their phones out, messaging each other in their private group and videoing constantly, violating people's privacy, whilst arguing that such measures were necessary for the protection of the community. Like I said, I wasn't keen to get involved, even though I didn't agree with what these people were doing or the way they conducted themselves. But this all changed one night when I witnessed a violent altercation that I couldn't ignore. I was watching television in my front room with the curtains drawn when suddenly I heard a commotion from outside as raised voices and the sounds of a scuffle caused me concern. The hairs on the back of my neck stood on end as I slowly made my way to the window and discreetly peeked out through the curtains. I saw a disturbing scene unfolding on the road and illuminated by the streetlights. The vigilante patrol was there, of course. Widow Jones wasn't present as far as I could see, but the rest of the gang were there, and no doubt following their leader's orders. My four neighbors had formed a tight circle surrounding a teenage boy who had, unfortunately, fallen afoul of their patrol. The kid had dark hair and a thin stubble on his chin, which I guessed was his adolescent attempt to grow a beard. He wore a tracksuit and a baseball cap, and he was giving attitude to the watch members, talking back and trying to look tough. However, I could just about see the frightened expression on his face under the dim light. Clearly, the kid was scared. I was uncomfortable at witnessing this scene, and unfortunately, it soon escalated. I guess the teenager must have made an insulting comment toward Mrs. Smith, because her husband stepped forward to defend his wife's honor. Mr. Smith was a big guy, and he didn't hold back, punching the kid so hard in the stomach that he keeled over in pain. This was too much for me. All of a sudden, I experienced a surge of adrenaline, which prompted me into action. Before I knew it, I was charging out into the street, ready to confront the aggressors for the first time. However, I think my courage started to waver once I was halfway across the asphalt, because when I shouted at the mob, my voice was already breaking. "Hey there! You can't do that! Leave the kid alone!" In an instant, all four turned in my direction, all casting me furious glares. I think they were surprised that I challenged them, and there was a pause before anyone spoke. In the end, it was the colonel who piped up, speaking to me in a tone which was both authoritative and condescending at the same time. "This is none of your concern, young man. You should return to your home without delay." As it happened, the colonel wasn't much older than I was, but I knew they all looked down their noses at me. I was invisible to them, a quiet and passive neighbor who they could boss around when they wanted to, but otherwise ignored. But I'd had enough of this shoddy treatment. Wouldn't turn a blind eye to this. But before I could reply, the teenager pulled himself up off the ground and cried out to me with terror in his voice. "Hey man, you gotta help me. These guys are crazy." Mr. Smith responded by giving the kid a hard slap across the back of his head. The teenager yelped in pain and shock. He tried to run, but Mr. Smith and the colonel grabbed him, holding him firmly as he struggled in vain. "Hey, you can't do that," I shouted. "Yes, we can," the colonel replied confidently. "This little hoodlum is the one who's been egging our houses and cars. We're effecting a citizen's arrest, as is our right under law." "Oh, come on," I shot back. "He's just a kid who played a few stupid pranks. Hardly a criminal mastermind." The kid continued to struggle as the colonel opened his mouth to reply. I could tell from his facial expression that the military man was fast losing his patience with me. Meanwhile, Mrs. Smith and Harriet had remained strangely silent during the exchange, but I now noticed how they both had their phones out and were recording. They weren't videoing the incident with the teenager. Instead, they were filming me, cruel smirks on their lips as they sought to intimidate me. "Have you ever heard of the broken windows theory?" the colonel eventually asked. "Today it's vandalism, tomorrow it'll be break-ins, and the day after that, we'll be dealing with violent muggings. It's a slippery slope. We must act now to avoid anarchy further down the line." I could hardly believe the twisted logic of this argument, and couldn't think of what to do next. But later, a moment later, a car pulled up in front of me, a black sedan which I recognized right away. It was Mrs. Jones' car, and a woman herself was in the driving seat. She lowered her window and stared out at me with her piercing green eyes. In an instant, I felt like a guilty child as all my former confidence melted away. Mrs. Jones wasn't so much angry as she was surprised by my presence, and she asked, "What are you doing here?" I opened my mouth to respond, but I discovered I couldn't find the words. I don't know why, but the woman had that effect on me, and I wasn't able to stand up to her at that moment. Instead, it was left to the colonel to explain the situation from his perspective. "This gentleman's causing trouble," he said. "He doesn't like the way we do things." "Well, isn't that a shame?" Widow Jones replied in a very patronizing tone. Of course, our neighbor hadn't bothered to ask. He'd know we're bringing this individual to the police so he can be dealt with appropriately. Everything we're doing is perfectly legal and above board. With that, Mrs. Smith and Harriet opened the car doors whilst continuing to film me, while the colonel and Mr. Smith forced the boy into the back seat. I saw the pure terror in the kid's eyes as he fought against the two grown men holding him and cried out in protest. "No! Let go of me, you assholes! You can't do this to me!" Deep down, I knew they weren't taking the kid to the cops. I knew, but still, I did nothing. Instead, I looked on helplessly as the entire group piled inside Mrs. Jones' car and drove off. The kid turned his head and looked out at me through the rear windscreen, his eyes pleading for help, which I had failed to provide. I experienced an intense guilt as I stood on the curb, watching as the car reached the end of the street and turned, soon disappearing from sight. I returned to my home soon after the incident, but I couldn't rest, as the stress of what I'd just witnessed kept me awake. I decided to do the responsible thing and call the cops to explain what had happened. An officer took down my report and said he'd look into it. I guess I should have realized that they were fobbing me off, but I did feel slightly better after I hung up the phone. I'd done my civic duty, and surely the police would ensure the kid was dealt with fairly. With this task completed, I was finally able to sleep. But little did I know that this was only the beginning of my nightmare. I went to work the next day as normal and gradually forgot about the ugly incident the night before. It was only once I arrived home that I received an unpleasant reminder. I drove up to my house and parked in my driveway, only to find an unwelcome visitor brazenly sitting on my front porch waiting for me. It was Mrs. Jones, wearing a long black dress and matching shroud like she often did, her white hair in curls, and her piercing eyes staring directly at me. She was sat upon a wooden bench in front of my home like she owned the place and I was the intruder. I sighed deeply as I exited my car and walked over to the woman, dreading the difficult conversation that was surely coming. Widow Jones smiled when she saw me, a false grin, etched across her wrinkled face, which I could tell was completely put on. "Good evening, sir," she said while standing up to meet me. Hi, Mrs. Jones," I said sheepishly. "What can I do for you?" I noted how she was blocking my route to my own front door, and yet I couldn't summon the courage to push past her. It's amazing how this elderly woman of small physical stature could have such power over me. "Well, neighbor, I just thought we should catch up after the incident last night. Make sure there were no misunderstandings." "I see," I said, whilst looking over my shoulder and scanning the street. I couldn't shake the unpleasant feeling that I was being watched. "I understand you contacted the sheriff's department," she continued. I felt a cold chill run up my spine upon hearing those words. How did she know I'd called the cops? "I can see your surprise," Mrs. Jones said. "Well, you should know that I'm an old friend of the sheriff and his wife, and we work closely with the local police." "What'd you do with the kid?" I interjected, suddenly finding my voice. Widow Jones looked angry at the interruption, but retained her cool composure and answered me. "We did nothing to them. The police released the young man with a warning, but I understand he's currently missing. The poor kid is clearly very disturbed. I hope he can find peace." "That's a load of BS," I exclaimed angrily. "You hurt that kid. I know you did." The woman glared at me, her eyes practically cutting through me. I couldn't meet her gaze, and in that moment, I feared I'd gone too far. And then Widow Jones started walking down the steps, slowly and purposely. Soon she was right up beside me, placing her cold hand on my shoulder and whispering in my ear. I was paralyzed by fear, unable to move or resist her poisonous words. "Turn around," she ordered. "There's something I want to show you." I did as instructed, as if I was now under her spell. She pointed to the house directly across the street. "Now what do you see?" she asked cryptically. "It's Mr. Anderson's place," I replied nervously. "Indeed," the widow confirmed. "You see the garish color he's painted his fence, the long grass and untidy hedges, those damn pigeons he keeps in his backyard that crap all over the street? He makes noise and upsets all of our neighbors. I've spoken to him many times, but he never listens. Alas, I don't think Mr. Anderson's going to last much longer on our street. He really isn't our type of people." She paused briefly, looking directly at me with those damned, bewitching eyes. "What about you, young man? Are you a good neighbor or a bad one?" She didn't wait for an answer before continuing. "I used to think you were one of the good guys. You never complained or made a fuss. I always did as you were told. But then you started harassing my people, going to the cops, making wild accusations. If I were you, I'd be careful. Very careful indeed. I snorted in an attempt to sound dismissive, but in truth I was frightened, and I think she knew it. Satisfied that her message was delivered, Widow Jones calmly walked down my driveway, casting me a parting glare and a cruel smirk as she crossed the street. And I just stood there and didn't say a word. I didn't sleep at all that night and wasn't able to focus the next day at work. I just couldn't forget the widow's chilling words and her implied threat. What had she done to the missing kid? And what would she do to me if I stepped out of line? I didn't go straight home after work. Instead, I left my car at the office and went to a local bar to drown my sorrows. I got a cab home later that night, feeling worse for wear after drinking heavily. My recollection is somewhat hazy at this point in the evening, but I do recall the taxicab pulling up onto our street and parking opposite my house. I paid the driver and shakingly exited my cab. But then I rubbed my eyes, and guess who was standing on the curb watching me? It was Widow Jones and her people. The 5 members of that damn community watch, all of them glaring at me with disapproval and contempt in their eyes as I drunkenly made my way across the otherwise quiet street. I couldn't stand their scornful looks, and I guess the alcohol granted me renewed courage because I shouted across at the group with defiant anger, crying, "You can all go to hell, you damn psychopaths!" The Colonel, the Smiths, and Harriet continued to glare at me with pure hatred in their dark eyes, but they didn't act or utter a word. Mrs. Jones's reaction to my outburst was rather different, however. She simply smiled at me, shooting a wide but very disturbing grin while she raised her hand and wagged her finger at me, telling me off like I was a disobedient puppy who'd peed on the carpet. However, I wasn't in the mood to back down on this occasion, so I defiantly gave her the middle finger before shouting, "Screw you too, you old witch!" I expected an angry rebuke, but the widow's smile did not falter. Suddenly, I felt extremely uneasy as I stumbled along my driveway and up my front steps, fumbling for my keys before I retreated inside the house and slammed the door shut behind me. I didn't have any trouble falling asleep. Thanks to my alcohol intake, I pretty much collapsed on my bed and passed out. But my slumber was far from restful, my dreams plagued by images of Widow Jones as she haunted my subconscious. In one nightmare, I charged across the street to attack her, only to find my punches were weak and useless. She brushed me off with the mere flick of her hand, laughing cruelly as I fell heavily to the curb and couldn't get back up. And when she looked down upon me with her predatory eyes, I knew I was entirely at her mercy. I guess I must have been out for a couple hours before I was rudely awakened by a loud banging noise. I shot up from my pillow in a panic, soon realizing that somebody was trying to smash my front door down. No prizes for guessing who it was. Suddenly, I felt quite sober as I jumped up from my bed and went to the window, looking down to see the community watch members standing on my porch. All wore black clothes and hoods, but were clearly recognizable. And to my horror, I saw all 4 were armed. Colonel carried a sawed-off shotgun while the 2 women wielded sharp daggers, and Mr. Smith was swinging a sledgehammer, smashing it against my front door in a determined effort to break in. My heart beat fast in my chest, and I struggled to breathe. Meanwhile, my panicked brain desperately tried to come up with a plan. I grabbed hold of my phone and started to dial 911, but then I remembered what Widow Jones had told me the day before. She was friends with the sheriff, so would the cops even come? I was still considering this when my phone started to ring. I looked at the screen and I saw I had an incoming call from an unknown number. I swiped with a shaking hand, pressing the phone to my ear as I spoke through trembling lips. "Hello?" I said as the banging on my door continued. "I did warn you," said the voice on the other end. It was the voice I recognized right away, that of Widow Jones. "You won't get away with this," I spat back. "You and your attack dogs are going to get caught." Widow Jones laughed in open mockery. "Oh, I don't know, so. The police are no danger to us, and none of the residents will say a word. As for you, well, you're all alone. You don't have close family or friends. Who's going to notice if you disappear? Who will even care? I felt a lump in my throat and tears welling up in my eyes. Meanwhile, the banging grew louder, and I knew my door wouldn't hold for much longer. I didn't know what to say, but Mrs. Jones wasn't done. I'm a fair woman, so I'm giving you one last chance. My people have got a taste for killing after they dispatched the teenage hoodlum. I know how to control them, but the gang have a lust for blood tonight. Somebody's going to die. That's inevitable. It's either going to be you or somebody more deserving. Suddenly the door smashed open, and I heard heavy boots stomping on my hardwood floor. I continued to cower in my bedroom, knowing I had no means to defend myself. But I continued to clutch a tight hold of my phone, realizing Mrs. Jones offered my only lifeline. "Time for a decision," she said ominously. "I need to say you'll be a good neighbor and do what you're told. I demand total obedience." I heard them storming up the staircase and knew that I'd run out of time. I almost choked out the words, but somehow I managed to reply, and what I said would haunt me to the end of my days. "I'll do it. I'll do whatever you want," I whimpered. "Good boy," she replied smugly, before abruptly ending the call. By now the mob had reached my bedroom, and all four stood in the doorway with manic looks in their murderous eyes, and their weapons at the ready. I backed off and held up my hands defensively. I'd done what their leader wanted, but feared it was already too late. Then, a moment later, I heard a cacophony of ringing phones and watched as all four of my assailants reached into their pockets and withdrew their devices. I stood frozen as I observed their gang quietly reading the message they'd all received. And suddenly, the murderous tension in the room faded, and the four lowered their weapons and reluctantly moved away from the doorway, making their way back down the stairs. The colonel was the last to leave, shooting me a killer's glare before he moved away. My heart was still beating fast as I ran back to my bedroom, in time to see the vigilantes exiting my home and quickly making their way across the street to Mr. Anderson's house. And I knew the mob had a new target. I experienced a renewed terror, watching helplessly as Mr. Smith went to work on my neighbor's door, smashing it hard several times with his hammer before he broke through. Next, all four piled inside of Mr. Anderson's home, screaming blue murder as they continued their rampage. I heard a violent scuffle inside the house, closely followed by a gunshot. Mr. Anderson's pigeons reacted to the loud noise by flying upwards into the night sky. Then there was a brief pause before poor Mr. Anderson stumbled out of his front door and onto the street. He was only in his underwear, in a hole in his stomach, wheezing in agony as his blood poured from the freshly made bullet wound. For a moment I thought he might make it to safety, but the vigilantes soon followed him outside. The colonel stood back, still smoking gun in his hands, as he observed his bloody handiwork. The two women, Mrs. Smith and Harriet, ran forward, knocking Mr. Anderson down before setting upon him with their knives, stabbing him repeatedly while he lay helpless on the asphalt. Mr. Anderson screamed, and I felt sick to my stomach at witnessing such savage violence. The women must have stabbed him more than a dozen times in the chest before they finally stopped, their clothes and faces now covered in dark blood. Amazingly, Mr. Anderson was still breathing. But this state of affairs didn't last for long. As the women stepped back, Mr. Smith stepped forward, using immense strength to wield his hammer, bringing it down upon Mr. Anderson's head and crushing his skull like it was a watermelon. I couldn't stand the bloody viscera, recoiling and retreating from the window and retching in disgust. And the worst thing was knowing I was at least partly responsible. Mr. Anderson had died because I'd given in to the tyrant. He'd died so I could live. By dawn, the murder scene had been cleaned up. Mr. Anderson's body was removed and presumably disposed of, and the blood and gore were carefully washed off the road. It was like nothing had ever happened. The police weren't called, and no one living in the neighborhood said a word. To this day, I don't know why Widow Jones turned from being a neighborhood busybody to a cold-blooded killer. Perhaps something inside of her snapped, or maybe she was always this way, deep down. Nor do I understand the hold she has over the members of her murderous neighborhood watch. Is she a witch with supernatural powers, or simply a human monster with a cult-like following possessing psychotic tendencies? I don't have the answers, and I now realize that this situation is beyond me. I see the way she looks at me, and I know it's only a matter of time before she sends her attack dogs to finish what they started. Call me a coward, if you will, but I don't want to die here. My bags are packed, and I'm leaving tonight. I can only pray that I never see Mrs. Jones or any of her vicious cult again for as long as I live. I hope you enjoyed Mrs. Jones' Neighborhood Watch by Finn McCool, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Finn-McCool. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/FINN-MCCOOL. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. I have a question. How would the Neighborhood Watch feel about a for sale sign? Something tells me that a lot of houses there would have a lot of signs, but also say that the previous owner vanished under mysterious circumstances. But despite the best efforts, no community is immune from trouble. Why, even the very elites with their country clubs and whatnot can still run into the most difficult of families and their members. Take, for instance, this little tale from Nikki Exposito about a particular family that seems to cause trouble of the most outrageous kind in a high-class atmosphere. Without further ado, I present to you, no longer welcome at the Six Seahorse Sands Club. Sirs and madams, this correspondence will serve as official notice. The Whittington Stanley family is hereby banned from the Six Seahorse Sands Country Club. Dr. Mortimer Whittington Stanley, Mrs. Cornelia Whittington Stanley, their sons Roderick Whittington Stanley and Elliot Whittington Stanley, as well as any and all relations and associates, are forbidden from club grounds. Club management and staff have extended to this family the utmost patience and grace. We've explained the rules and the consequences of breaking said rules many times, many ways, in the plainest of English. Yet still, the disreputable clan has it set in their heads that the rules don't apply to them, a delusion from which they're incapable of being weaned. Enough is enough. To avoid conversational unpleasantness and to shield the Six Seahorse Sand staff from an unabating deluge of repetitive and benign questions, I will catalog here the series of misadventures culminating in the Whittington Stanley's banishment. 1. The Van Beek-Wallace Wedding. Let's not mince words. Wilbur Van Beek was an unpleasant man. In fact, to be completely frank, I found Mr. Van Beek the most distasteful embodiment of simultaneous opulence and cheapness. I will freely admit I've spent many a night reorganizing the cutlery closet simply to avoid his diatribes about estate tax law. But, lest we forget, we all accepted Mr. Van Beek's stock tips without complaint and were happy to indulge in the fine French champagne he brought home from Paris Fashion Week, as well as the attentions of the leggy French beauties whose passage to America and enrollment at the finest modeling academies in the city, Mr. Van Beek kindly funded. And during our unfortunate financial bottleneck last spring, Mr. Van Beek offered the club an extremely generous loan to repave the tennis courts. Because of this generosity, many of you were obliged to cheerfully attend the wedding of Mr. Van Beek's daughter, Madeline, to Mr. Ashton Plank Wallace III. Again, I will not mince words. The event was a grotesque carnival of plutocracy, offensive to club management and our valued members not possessing the financial largesse required to, say, hire an African lion and giraffe calf from the elite rental company displayed in cages during cocktail hour. The caviar station was wholly unnecessary, as were the imported Spanish red jumbo prawns, the prime cuts of steak butchered on Mr. Van Beek's Texas ranch, and the exotic sushi prepared by master chefs flown in from Tokyo. The wedding cake would have been perfectly sumptuous without a coating of gold leaf, and 18 tears were at least 5 too many. I'm sure Miss Van Beek's dress could have arrived through channels besides a private plane from Milan, and a man whose wealth commands imported prawns and private planes could definitely have insisted less forcefully upon a no-tip policy for the servers and bartenders. But I digress. The point is, it was during this singular occasion that young Mr. Elliot Whittington Stanley decided to, well, let's say, entertain the 327 wedding guests with a lively, practical joke. You see, young Mr. Whittington Stanley had spent his last few afternoons in the club teen center, teaching his peers a certain Latin incantation he found on the internet. 30 minutes into the wedding ceremony and 15 minutes into Miss Van Beek's vows, Madeline was a lovely girl, but we can all agree she possessed the charisma of a potted plant. Elliot stood abruptly and waved his hand. In response, a cobble of 20 boys rose to their feet and in horrendous unison began to chant, "Mortuae resurgere, mortuae resurgere, mortuae resurgere." As the boys chanted, they stomped their feet in a dreadful rhythm, oblivious to the perplexed and mortified exclamations of their parents and elders. Exclamations gave way to screams as the ground began to quake and fissure, and then, like dandelions from the underworld, skeletal hands burst through the perfectly manicured grass. The skeletal hands were attached to gray, sinewy arms, attached to rotting torsos closed in mildewy leather armor, attached to waxy, worm-eaten heads with empty eye sockets glowing blood red. The reanimated Draugr army had risen from their graves, summoned by the chants of Elliot Whittington Stanley and his delinquent coterie. It pains me to recall the rest of that nightmarish day. Guests screeched and fainted and trampled all over each other, destroying the lawn with their heels. The scent of vomit, urine, and feces soon mingled with the unimaginable fetor of the unearthed Draugr. The Draugr army sprayed Miss Van Beek's dress with curdling intestines. The grunting, mindless creatures shattered the great hall chandelier, reduced the handmade centerpieces to tatters, and tore apart the ballroom like a natural disaster. They tipped the wedding cake into the pond, shattered the mermaid ice sculpture, and scattered Spanish red jumbo prawns across the golf course. For weeks afterward, golfers found rotting prawns stuffed into holes and discarded in sand traps. The Draugr army ate the giraffe and uncaged the lion, which proceeded to chase terrified groomsmen into the harbor. Then, somehow, the Draugr designated the waitstaff an opposing army. The undead horrors proceeded to corral the terrified waiters and bartenders and busboys and corner them in the bridal suite, where the service workers, who weren't even approaching adequate compensation to face a zombie apocalypse, spent a frantic hour until club management could gather the house mages and a counter-incantation return the Draugr army to their subterranean sleep. As expected, the very next day, Mr. Wilbur Van Beek withdrew both his club membership and his promised loan. To this day, the tennis court has not been repaved. Ladies and gentlemen, I should not need to say this. The Draugr army that rests eternally under club grounds is not a toy. It was installed by the founders of the Six Seahorse Sands Club as a line of defense in the event of a lower-class uprising. It's not a prop to be utilized for childish pranks. 2. Jacob Steinberg's Bar Mitzvah. Unfortunately, this event began as something of a mess. The rabbi missed his exit off the expressway and drove halfway to the Hamptons before correcting his mistake, which left guests milling awkwardly about the ballroom for an hour before the ceremony commenced. Young Jacob uncomfortably stuttered his way through his Torah recitation for what felt like another hour. That poor sweet boy was not the brightest candle on the chandelier. And then there were the matter of the golems. A specific minority of invitees, mostly the parents of Jacob's friends not holding memberships to the Six Seahorse Sands Club, were quite perturbed by the presence of the golems in lieu of human waiters. The some-foot-tall, gray clay men with their featureless bodies, club-like feet, fiery eyes, and gaping mouths did make for a peculiar sight. But Dr. Irving Steinberg had been quite insistent on their presence for two reasons. Firstly, word of the Van Beek wedding fiasco made its way around circles of catering staff in the city, and precious few were eager to accept work at the club and risk a second occurrence. Secondly, the massive clay automatons would serve as a platoon of bodyguards, lest Elliot Whittington Stanley get it into his head to plan another hilarious joke. This time, however, it was Elliot's younger brother, little Roderick Whittington Stanley, whose shenanigans necessitated intervention. Little Roderick's mother, during an awkward hour the assembled patrons waited for the rabbi, had given her younger son a sheet of paper and crayons with which to occupy himself. The boy proceeded to scribble a funny little monster. During the ceremony, he managed to wander away from his mother and somehow climb up the back of a golem. Then the irrepressible scamp reached his chubby little hand into the golem's mouth, removed the shim and replaced it with his crumpled doodle. This immediately rendered the golem, all 7 feet of it, built like a torpedo, Roderick Whittington Stanley's personal man Friday. And what, pray, would a 7-year-old boy ask of an indestructible manservant, beholding only to his whims? The golem accosted Miss Susan Brightboer, custodian of the Six Seahorse Sands Little Crab Children's Club, snatched her wig right off her head, and displayed it as a grotesque trophy atop the south turret. The golem raided the kitchen, plowed its way into the patisserie, and made off with a vat of rosewater ice cream, a Boston cream pie, and 6 dozen chocolate chip cookies, which it proceeded to devour with its young charge. Next, the golem, little Roderick in tow, invaded the esoteric library where the pair terrorized visiting scholars by hiding behind shelves of scrolls, then sprinting out like imps, screaming poop and fart. When the house mages attempted to subdue the creature, it placed Roderick on its shoulders and led its pursuers on a wild steeplechase across club grounds, the little boy screaming, missed me, now you've got to kiss me, all the while. In the end, the house mages could do little to disarm a creature of clay and stone. The Steinbergs and their guests simply had to make do until the sugar high wore off, and both Roderick Whittington Stanley and his commandeered golem curled up asleep under the swing sets. Note to all club members, please mind your children, and be considerate of their maturity before bringing them to any club event. 3. The Six Seahorse Sands Daddy-Daughter Cotillion. The Daddy-Daughter Cotillion is amongst the club's most beloved traditions. Young girls are offered the opportunity to perfect their social graces in a kind, non-judgmental environment shepherded lovingly by a paternal figure. If club members have no daughters of their own, they're still encouraged to attend the daddy-daughter cotillion in the company of, say, a young female cousin or a favorite niece. Members, however, are not permitted to escort the reanimated corpse of a teenage girl who died of consumption in 1835. They are especially not allowed to bring such a guest if her lower half has been substituted with the legs of a horse and her body has undergone the addition of a scorpion tail. These and all similar beings are explicitly forbidden from the daddy-daughter cotillion, even if, as Dr. Mortimer Whittington Stanley insisted, the ghastly chimera was created in a member's basement laboratory, named Arabella, and claimed as a daughter. Here at the Six Seahorse Sands Club, we take our commitment to non-discrimination very seriously, but I'm sure you'll agree this stunt was a bridge too far. 4. A reminder of our policy regarding Kelpie rentals. Members are allowed to borrow Kelpies, also known as water horses, from the club's stables on an hourly basis, so long as they remain with the creatures on club grounds. However, the Kelpies must be returned to the stable on the North Harbor and checked back in with staff. The Kelpies may not simply be abandoned in their South Harbor because the renter, say, Elliot Whittington Stanley, lost interest and couldn't rustle up the wherewithal to return the water horse to its appropriate home. We keep the mermaids in the South Harbor. The mermaids are territorial, and they will perceive a Kelpie as an invading species and attack. Kelpies are also kept away from the club swimming pool. Again, please mind your children. They mustn't lead their Kelpies to the pool because, as Roderick Whittington Stanley reasoned, the water horse is cold and should be warmed up in the heated chlorinated water. The Kelpies who keep the pool and spa find the presence of a water horse highly offensive, and when offended, they have a tendency to become feral. 5. The tennis courts incident. File this under things I shouldn't need to say. Sigils are not to be drawn on the tennis courts. It is highly inappropriate and in a direct violation of club policy to summon a spirit with chalk on the blacktop, and is doubly inappropriate to summon Abaddon, the destroyer, to terrorize club grounds, particularly if Abaddon, the destroyer, is summoned by a certain 12-year-old boy, for instance, Elliot Whittington Stanley, because his mom says he has to go to his tennis lesson even if he doesn't want to. Which brings us, finally, to the occurrence that served as the proverbial final nail in the coffin of the Whittington Stanley family. 6. Poppy Strauss Bachelorette Party. The very existence of Poppy Strauss's wedding serves as conclusive proof for that old cliché. There is somebody out there for everybody. Miss Strauss was an attractive enough young woman, and she exuded an aura of culture and intelligence. But her temperament could be best compared to a swarm of bees, and her personality swung from pretentious to deliberate ignorance toward anything that contradicted her very high opinion of herself. I won't dare intimate Clifford Van Doren married her solely to obtain a piece of her family's highly profitable chain of seafood restaurants, but I will venture young Mr. Van Doren had always been driven by ambition at the expense of his heart's desire. I was, admittedly, charitable of Miss Cornelia Whittington Stanley to volunteer to act as Miss Strauss's matron of honor. Young Poppy's attitude won her a few friends amongst the club's young female membership, and it was well known that she, familiar with the disaster that became of the Van Beek Wallace wedding, plotted her own nuptials like a general plotting a coup. You see, Miss Strauss spent years embroiled in a largely one-sided social rivalry with Madeline Van Beek, And with Miss Van Beek removed from the Six Seahorse Sands Club membership rolls, her metaphorical throne was left for the taking. Poppy Strauss announced her wedding's theme as A Night in the Agora and went to the ancient Greek angle like a fox at a mink. The long-suffering bridesmaids, unsuspecting cousins, and Shanghai'd sorority sisters would don silken togas. A string quartet of nymphs was procured to entertain guests during cocktail hour. Madeline Van Beek's dress had been flown in from Milan? Well, Poppy Strauss would fly to the altar on the back of a Pegasus. I understand, under the circumstances, Mrs. Cornelia Whittington Stanley must have been saddled with immense pressure to plan a bachelorette party fitting of Poppy Strauss's grand intentions. And it's difficult to lay blame at her feet for simply attempting to calm her friend, to ply her with liquor and unwind her tangled constitution, if only for a night. But all this is no excuse for what happened next. To host Miss Strauss's bachelorette party, thrown in the Lilith wing of the club, Mrs. Whittington, Stanley, summoned Dionysus himself, along with his legion of bocce. By 8:45, the Lord of Revelry had assembled young women dancing on tables, draining shot after shot of Patron, tearing off their dresses and dashing, shrieking across the golf course in their underclothes. But the bocce, possessed party girls with long claws and sharp teeth, could not be sated until each and every club member, house staff, manager, cook, bartender and caddy on the premises was fully engaged in the debauchery. There is an unwritten rule here at the Six Seahorse Sands Club. No one is to speak of that night. Those who were present remember little. Flashes of swimming nude in the harbor, arms wrapped around a scaly fishtail, seaweed air brushing one's face, breaking down the doors of the esoteric library, then blue flames, then swaying along, transfixed, as horned creatures scaled the walls with hoofed feet. Racing atop kelpies and pegasi, and on the back of firebirds, chasing leprechauns and imps through the servant hallways. Faint recollections of twirling round and around under a starlit sky, hands clasping tentacles. What club management, not present that night, remember, vividly, is the morning after. Every drop of alcohol on club premises had been sucked dry. The liquor room was reduced to a pile of broken glass. The wine cellar, which once boasted the largest collection of 17th century Italian vintage in the country, had been looted. Bridesmaids and golfers and yachters and assorted club employees, as well as dryads and mermaids and fauns and nephilim, lay about in various states of consciousness and various states of undress. I will spare you the description of the state of the facilities, but, as you all well know, the Six Seahorse Sands Club was shuttered for a month. It took the host, Magies, that long to close every portal, banish every djinn to its dimensional plane, and sing every summoned old god back to enchanted sleep. Like I said, enough is enough. The Whittington Stanley family is incompatible with the peaceful, refined culture we strive to maintain at the Six Seahorse Sands Club. By this proclamation, they are blackballed from the premises until further notice. Thank you for your continued compliance. Six Seahorse Sands Club Management. I hope you enjoyed No Longer Welcome at the Six Seahorse Sands Club by Nikki Exposito, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Nikki-Exposito. That's simplyscarypodcast.com nicky-exposito. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. I don't know about you, but that sounds like a pretty happening place. But I'm guessing they wouldn't take me as a member. I've got more skeletons in the closet than they have armies under the dance floor. Tonight draws to a close with this lovely little traipse, with that most awful of all neighborhood problems, the people right next door. Well, not all the time. Many times our direct neighbors are thoughtful people that you can share a chat or a drink with. But then, as Dale Thompson reveals, there are people that, I don't know, have habits that seem wildly out of character for the rest of the neighborhood. Like homegrown church services, late-night chanting, and then the tied-up farm animals in the yards. Without further ado, I present to you, The Neighborhood's Gone to Hell. My name's Ethan. My family and I lived in an idyllic neighborhood, on an idyllic street, in an idyllic house that we worked and saved to buy over the course of approximately 10 long years. My wife, Katie, and I had two little boys at the time, Nathan and William, and we settled into our new ranch-style home with a plush green backyard. There were even two pear trees in the small yet usable backyard, which butted up against a wooded area. I suppose we'd only been there a short while, living the dream, as they say, when we started to notice the word idyllic was probably overused. I'd say our place went from picturesque to bucolic, reflective, never blissful, then downgraded to bland suburbia. It dropped even further down the semi-rural scale to spoiled and incongruous for our needs and likes. I won't tell you exactly what happened, and you can hear for yourself how quaint and peaceful can turn, like the weather, to bleak and foreboding. After we settled and had been there a short while, we began to hear rumors that floated to us from Illinois, who lived a few doors up the street, a widow twice over, and now, happily, residing alone. It seemed that Emily somehow had a nose for news and gossip, and others gravitated to her, drawn like magnet tale-bearers to her kitchen, where she served them mid-morning coffee, tea, or homemade pie and bread. These prattlers were always spinning yarns in the rumor mill, and some very interesting stories were birthed forth, some true and others fabricated. We already knew that the lady who lived next door to us, Tressie Sample, was a religious fanatic, ringing a bell on Sunday morning in her garage that she used as a home church on the weekends. The percussive sound was loud enough to wake the dead. We knew there was no sleeping in on Sunday morning because she would shatter the silence with that infernal clanging piece of iron. It felt like wringing her neck, but if this was what she did, then who was I, or we, to go against what was normal on the street? I just wished we had been shown our house on a Sunday before we signed the contract. We may have reconsidered. But the bell was not the worst of it. The mountain worship music, which raged frantically for 2 to 3 hours, would ensue after the gathering of a dozen or so attendees. Not only was the singing unbearably off-key, but they would hoot and holler and shout and rejoice as if Jesus had descended upon them. One Saturday evening, since I knew what was coming the following morning, I decided to take a walk next door and speak with Tressie about the bell ringing. I was apprehensive, and Katie urged me not to go. She said she did not want a feud with the neighbor. I walked up her blacktop drive to the side of the house, where people seemed to go when they were there visiting. Before I made it to the door, I was abruptly stopped by a man who I assumed was her husband. He had an axe in his hand and was sweating profusely. I assumed he was chopping wood. He wore a white tank top, which I called a wife-beater tee, and the looks of this lean, hard-faced man were probably the very reason the simple tank top got renamed. Hello, I'm Ethan from next door. As bad as I hated to shake his clammy hand, I stuck it out as a peaceful introduction. Yeah, I know who you are. He did not introduce himself, but glared, squinting his eyes to thin slits, as his expression scowled at me with distrust. I withdrew my olive branch and asked him, I was wondering if your wife's home. There's a matter I'd like to discuss with her. A matter? You got a matter, do you? Maybe I got a matter that I'd like to discuss with your wife as well. He emphasized the word your while becoming irate and unreasonable. Our conversation just went from 0 to 60 faster than a supercar. I'm not here for confrontation. I just wanted to ask her if she could refrain from ringing the bell so early on Sunday morning. I smiled cordially. His eyes remained fastened on me, and I took more notice of his axe, which he was slowly twisting in his hand. Then he shouted so concussively I shuddered. Tracy! Tracy! There's someone here who wants an audience with you. I had to gather my nerves because in the second it took him to disarm all of my defenses with the shout, he could have just as easily taken my head off with the axe, which I noticed had a sanguine stain on its blade. Good Lord, I trembled, questioning inside of my brain. What was he doing right before I interrupted his evening? Tressie appeared, waddling from the side door, which I'd tried to make to, before being cut off by her suspicious husband. Before she reached us, he took a look at me, then at the axe head, and smiled. Then, with a twisted grin that I'd only ever seen from clips of Charles Manson, he proclaimed, just loud enough for me to hear it, "There's always some killing you gotta do on the farm." Tracy was a porcine woman, stern-faced, with the strict look of an old-school English teacher. She obviously was not concerned with aesthetics. She wore her dull gray hair in the beehive, Pentecostal style, all piled up on top of her head, which caused her to appear taller than she was. "What is it, Wayne?" Now I knew her husband's name. Wayne, the axe murderer. No two people have ever glared at me with so much disdain, their eyes frozen, locked in on me, not blinking for such a length of time. One might remember Ross Perot, the 1996 presidential candidate for the Reform Party, or maybe not. But this billionaire said, "You know people are lying when they blink." And he proudly proclaimed that he seldom ever blinked. As much as I wanted this Pentecostal couple to blink, they did not, so I figured that they meant business. Something serious was going on here. Everything was happening at once. I was temporarily unable to keep up with the disorder. I don't believe I had ever found myself in a more awkward position. There was nothing for me to do except speak up. Man up and say what I came to say. "Do you think it's possible for you not to ring your morning bell so early on Sunday mornings?" The question seemed to have broken from their current frown of concentration, of trying to burn a hole through my head, and Tressie answered, "I ring that bell for God. It's a call to assemble the righteous, to gather them together as a mother hen does her chicks. It's rung for focus and clarity. Be mindful of the word of God, young man. It must be rung. The priests of old wore bells on their ephods, entering the Holy of Holies. While they could be heard ringing, that meant he was alive. If they ever stopped, he was dead. This is divine work that you would know nothing about. Do you know nothing of the Hebrew word pa'aman?" I shook my head no. I figured as much. "So, you see, you're ignorant of spiritual things. The bell must be rung," Tressie confessed. I could see I was fighting a losing battle. My attempt to deal with this issue was an impossibility. I graciously said, "Well, thank you anyway," and made my way home, leaving the two first-century Christians standing in their drive. "How'd it go, honey?" Katie asked. "About like I thought it would. They're not going to budge. And that woman's husband." I paused as if I had a nightmare of reflection, then continued. "I think he might be deranged." The bell continued to obliterate our sleep every Sunday morning, and the awkwardness of neighboring with these religious zealots became even more strained after Tressie decided that not only on Sunday would she have church in a garage, she also added Wednesday night Bible study to the calendar as well. One evening, before dusk, I made my way through our backyard to check on the pear tree when I heard a goat bleating. The sound of "Maha!" grabbed my attention, and that's when I saw the darndest thing. It was a full-size goat tied to a tree in Tressie's backyard. I stood in place, truly stunned by what I was seeing. I mumbled to myself for reassurance. What the devil do they want a goat for, need a goat for? What were their plans? I was severely troubled by the thought. I could not begin to conceptualize what I saw. I felt this excruciating uneasiness in my chest, like my heart was swollen. This was something other than an affliction of my physical heart. This was an emotional cry from within myself. I checked on the pears, all the while with that goat in my mind, who was mawing, stretching into a baying overtone at times, almost as if to say, "Save me!" I returned to the house to find Katie at the sink. She'd been watching me through the kitchen window while hand-washing some pans from the night's supper. "I saw you looking over at the Tressie Samples house. What was going on over there?" she asked as she was drying the saucepan with a towel. "You're not going to believe this, but those nut jobs have a goat tied up in their backyard." There was no way to dilute the truth, so I just said it. "A goat? You mean like a billy goat?" "I didn't see horns, but it was a goat," I answered. "You don't think they're going to sacrifice the poor thing, do you?" Katie's voice always sounded kind, and this time it was no different. I didn't say this to Katie, but I could not imagine them doing anything else with a goat. A sacrifice was exactly what I thought might happen to the poor defenseless creature. I tried to lighten my answer so it wouldn't sound so gruesome as a sacrifice. "Who's to say? I think they're capable of anything. I'm going to free it tonight after it gets dark," I said. "You're going to go steal their goat?" Katie asked. "I can't just let them kill it. Why else would they have a goat?" "It makes no sense," I said, becoming angrier as I thought about their heartless cruelty. I knew I had to save that goat from Tressie and her retinue cult. I asked Katie to keep the kids occupied while I did my dodginess. I didn't want them to learn of my cloak and dagger mission. They might just spill the beans, and it would circle around to Emily's rumor mill, and Tressie would possibly find out. I could just imagine Wayne storming over with his axe, and that wasn't something I wished to dwell on. After the sun had settled neatly on the horizon and the moon gave a faint hue through the trees behind our house, I marshaled my nerves and hurried out dressed in all black, carrying with me a butcher knife to cut the rope. I was afraid if I attempted to untie the nanny, it might take too long to fidget and fumble with possible multiple knots. I headed down into the woods first. There I could see the lights in their house and had a clear view of the goat. Clandestinely, I maneuvered from the woods to the edge of their property like an army ranger and crawled on my belly, rolling from one shadow to the other until I reached the shed. I speculated that they'd eaten dinner since it was so late, and that the light that I saw burning in the window was either a bedroom or the living room where I assumed they'd gathered. Hidden by the structure, I stood, and with my back against the shed, I slid down the wall to the tree where the goat was secured. Unmoving, I listened and heard chattering inside their house. That was a good thing. I couldn't afford to get caught. I could only envisage the unspeakable things they might do to me. I was about to do the unholy, take away their sacrifice to God. I would no doubt be the replacement. The goat paid no attention to me and bleated a couple of times, but not so much with purpose as before, and with speedy impulse, I cut the creature free and led it toward my own yard. I took the shortest course straight to my SUV, where, with some difficulty, because the animal was stubborn and uncooperatively strong, I managed to fit it into the back of my vehicle. And I thought, no blood sacrifice for you, my little friend. I drove several miles to a farm where I knew they raised goats. Possibly this one came from there. But I was not going across the state line with a stolen goat. I drove down a graveled road leading up to the Musses farm and, with some resistance, managed to drag the goat from the back of the SUV and remove the rope completely, which I tossed over a fence. The goat could not seem to have cared less, was absolutely oblivious, and began to munch on a clump of grass. I returned home, mission accomplished. As impractical as the decision was to set the goat free, it was done, and I slept knowing I'd done a good thing. The following day, I went to the garage to do some work. I had an old 67 convertible Mustang I was slowly restoring. It was a good project to keep me busy on days when Katie took the boys to her mother's house. I loved it out here, just piddling and dreaming of one day backing this beauty out of the garage and speeding down the highway with the top down and the wind in my hair. It was a Saturday, and the goat was long gone. I turned on the radio to a local rock station. Some top 40 band from the 80s was playing. It could have been something out of the Seattle music scene. I don't know. I retrieved a couple of wrenches from the toolbox and poked my head under the hood. I really needed my ratchet because I needed to take the valve covers off and replace the gaskets. Right when I picked up the ratchet, I heard a booming voice coming from next door. I nearly wet myself. There was no immediate explaining what was happening or a rationalized answer to why it was occurring. I stepped out of the garage, open door, and knew right away what it was. It was Tressie's grinding voice. She clearly had moved her church's PA system, and I used the word church very loosely, into one of her rooms in the house next to my garage. And she was preaching through an open window in the direction of my garage. The suffering of an eternal hell is real. An unregenerate man is a mere shade tumbling down into the abyss of everlasting hellfire, deep down into the lightless abyss. And in this pit of doom and despair, you'll suffer God's wrath. The devil will mock you, and you will burn with unquenchable fire until you lose existence altogether. That was the sort of insanity that was spewing from her mouth, and I had no defense. I thought I had no recourse, but I would be damned to allow her to drive me from my own garage. She wanted to talk about the shades of the dead, did she? I went for my CD collection, where I found the 1979 AC/DC album Highway to Hell. I hadn't listened to this album in quite some time, but I slipped it into my CD player and cranked it up, twisting the speakers around to face Tressie's house. I wish I could have seen her writhing in anguish as Bon Scott's voice croaked out the classic tune. It took the entire song to shut the old bat up next door, but it worked, and I went about my business under the hood of the Mustang. Later that same day, Katie and the boys returned home after a fun-filled day at Grandma's house. I briefly explained to Katie after supper, while the boys were playing in their room, what had occurred earlier in the garage. She said it was beyond her contemplation that anyone would be so cold and calloused, living right next door to someone. I assured her I had done nothing earlier to provoke such an attack. Night fell, and Katie and I had just fallen asleep when a persistent banging noise from outside startled both of us from our sleep. I immediately got dressed, shoved my bare feet into my slippers, and went out the back door with a flashlight in hand, stabbing at the darkness, until I saw where the hammering sound was coming from. There sat Wayne, as proud as a peach, in a folding lawn chair with some sort of metal tub in his lap, and he was relentlessly hammering away on the tub. He was still wearing that redneck white beater tee. What are you doing? I demanded to know. What does it look like I'm doing? Wayne was older than my own dad, so arguing with this senile twit was exhausting. It looks like you're trying to keep the neighbors up, I deduced. Not just any neighbors, only you. He banged on a few more times. How do you like that? Do you like the noise? Obstinately, he struck the tub with rage. His eyes didn't seem human. They were dark, dead, and depraved. I thought you people were Christians. Is this any way for Christians to act? We have children inside, and you're frightening them. I raised my voice to the same volume as my blood pressure. Katie then made an appearance in a robe and stood by me. Please, Mr. Samples, this is unconscionable. People are trying to sleep, she asked pleadingly. Then tell your husband to keep his demon music turned down. Wayne struck the tub twice more for good measure, and then he stood. Tracy could be seen lurking in the shadows, and another figure, someone big that I couldn't make out, was standing next to her, obscured from sight. But I noticed, even draped in darkness, dangling down from his right hand, pressed up against his leg, this big guy was gripping a machete. My blood was boiling. I had a firearm in the house, and in the moment of white heat, anger, and rage boiling up in me, it took all of my common sense and resolve not to retrieve it and put an end to this nonsense. But being the bigger man, I simply said to the shielded unknown figure, "You do not need that." There was no reply. Then Wayne gave me a crooked smile, truly showing what character of person he was. And then he said in an unsettling voice, smooth and unexcitable, "Her goat's gone." I mimicked the word "gone" as a question. "Yeah, it's missing. You would not by chance have seen it, have you?" His voice was rattled with accusation. I unashamedly lied and answered, "Nope." Tracy called to Wayne to come in now, and like a well-trained dog, Wayne gathered up his claw hammer and his bucket, folded up his chair, and started away to the side door. "If you see my goat, you'll let me know, won't you?" Right then, the dark became darker, and I got an awful chill. Katie and I returned to our house, and I made sure all the doors were locked. I'd never considered such precautions before, but now I seemed to be growing more paranoid as this bizarre tension between the neighbors and I continued. And who was that mysterious giant of a man with a machete? This was all inconceivable, and I saw no resolution. Every Sunday morning and Wednesday night, that diabolical bell would be rung, and Tressie's disciples would congregate, practicing their brand of worship, which I saw no truth in their services. I thought she was no more than a deceiver, a false prophet, practicing witchcraft, magic, and Chthonian darkness. There was no doubt in my mind that she was running a full-fledged cult. Most likely it was advisable for me to let it lay, just leave it alone. Yet every hour they remained next door, I simply couldn't stand it. I stopped discussing it with Katie because it only upset her. The boys asked a couple of times about the clanging of the bell, and I explained they were a religious sort, and that's what religious people do. I did walk up the road to Emily's house, who greeted me with a warm welcome, a smile and a chuckle, and then I was at her kitchen table having coffee and homemade peanut butter cookies. "Emily, do you know what's going on at Tressie's?" I just asked without reservations. I figured Emily thrived on this sort of thing. "They're nuts," she said plainly. Yeah, I get that. But does Tressie really believe she's doing God's work back there in that tiny garage?" I gladly got myself another chewy cookie. "She thinks she's the reincarnation of some old-time evangelist. I can't recall their name, but she feels she's carrying on the unfinished work." "Unfinished work?" I repeated while chewing. "Yes, Tressie's always been a strong personality, difficult to understand and harder to get along with. We've never been friends, but there was a time when we spoke often. Her real problem is her husband. He pretends she's in control, but Wayne is evil. I think he's using her for whatever unnatural gratification he's getting from it. She's a figurehead, but he rules the roost. Emily reached out and got herself a cookie. I eat too many of these, she chortled. Do they have a goal or purpose? I mean, what are they hoping to accomplish? Their son Larry just got out of prison. He's a big man and sneaky. They have two daughters who no longer visit him. I guess they had a falling out of sorts. But now that Larry's free again, they're determined to get him converted to God. Emily looked down at her coffee as if there was more to say. Grudgingly, Larry does not want any part of it, but as a felon, he has nowhere else to go. Brilliant, just brilliant, I thought to myself. Another patient at the funny farm next door. Now that I had a clearer picture of what we were up against, I say we, meaning Katie and I, but in reality it was just me. I thought I'd get some video footage of those attending her so-called church and sort this thing out as far as who was who and how dangerous they were. I had a clear view of the front of the garage from the vantage point of our bedroom window. Katie was adamantly against me spying on the neighbors. What other choice did I have? This was the only recourse, to gather information in order to exploit the enemy's weaknesses. It's called reconnaissance. I needed to know what made their Cimmerian minds tick. I did not trust them at all. I believe they were significantly avaricious and grandly menacious. Emily had told me that Larry was larcenous. A man with sticky fingers who would thieve and steal anything that was not bolted down, so I installed an extra lock on my side garage door. The first night yielded a lucrative amount of information, and here's the version I witnessed. Wayne had started a large bonfire much closer to the shed where he previously had the goat tied. It was a much larger fire than anything I would have wanted to deal with personally. It was practically an inferno. But being clever in incendiarism, he managed to keep it under control. A group of people had arrived in two separate minivans and piled out, every one of them wearing black. Some even wore black funeral veils over their faces. I found this intriguing. The fire was raging, and the guests gathered around the fire. Black balloons were released, and about a dozen shot up in the air, rising on the embers from the fire, each exploding to the cheers and jeers of the party guests. An uncharacteristic song was being sung a cappella by them all. Come into the circle of fire, the circle of song, as the light grows shorter and the night grows long. Each participant then presented a piece of paper and tossed together their papers into the fire. I couldn't hear the words Tressie spoke over the fire, but it seemed devilish, to say the least. Lifting their voices together, they recited something that went like, I welcome the old ones. Show us guiding spirits in this sacred space. Into these fires, I place messages for the lost close to my heart. If this wasn't the most peculiar thing I'd ever seen, I don't know what even comes close in comparison. Tracy had a vial in her hands, and she began to sprinkle the ointment onto the flames, and this caused them to raise even higher. She then spoke alone. I anoint this night, the night of sacrifice, that the old heart of the unlearned be cut asunder, and a new heart will begin to grow within. This is when two men led Larry, who I was seeing for the first time, into clear view because of the light of the fire. He seemed hesitant and afraid, and his reluctance was not missed by others around him as they gathered closer to him, blocking his retreat and escape. Katie had been lying in bed reading a book while I was doing my observations. Katie, you gotta see this. It's a human sacrifice, I think. Katie said, don't be silly. People do not make human sacrifices these days, do they? These people do. I think they're giving up their son to the fire, I said cryptically, though why I said it, I don't know. A was more invested in this than I thought I'd be, obviously shown by my weird dialect, which naturally spilled out. Katie came to the window and was amazed at how large the fire had gotten. "I think they need a permit to have a fire in the backyard," she said. "I don't believe that followers of the malevolent being who are in the process of breaking the cosmic order care about permits or the law," I told Katie. "This just isn't right." "Should we call the police or the fire department?" queried Katie. I continued my persistent watching, and what came next was tragic, if not oddly comedic. Larry, a large man with prison experience, became unstrung, moving with a necessary yet profoundly unpredictability. He leaped through the flames of firing, knowing he was no match for the mob surrounding him. Tracy yelled out, "Get him!" A contingency of young men ran around the blazing fire and gave chase. "I can't believe what I'm seeing," I said, continuing to shoot video footage. Katie was dumbfounded, occupied in thought, thoroughly entertained by the unusual fiasco. My heightened consciousness was on a level far beyond anything it had ever been. I expected to see spirits rise from the flames like wraiths and ghouls, but nothing of the sort happened. This episode augmented Larry's courage, running around the house, being chased closely by the others until fatigue caught up with him and the molesters tackled him near the fire. Tessie ordered Larry, "Drink the blood, eat the flesh. I strip Adam from your throne." In a state of panicked exaltation, I saw some sort of transformation take place in Larry. Initially, while on the ground, he fought, thrashed around, kicking at and punching the others until he was physically exhausted. He was being held on the ground in a state of uncomfortable prostration. Tracy held her hands high overhead and prayed to the skies. "Renew mentality. Change his fallen personality. Open his eyes to infinity. Imbue him with the Trinity. Bring forth a true identity and inject him with divinity." Larry appeared frozen, inert with terror, as Wayne stepped up and shoved what I can only describe as raw meat into Larry's mouth. Gagged and spat it out, coughing and sickly gagging, but Wayne shoved it back in. Another man, draped in some sort of druid-type cloak, poured what appeared to be blood upon Larry's head. The cruel nature of the assault was disturbing, to say the least. We could hear Larry's screams and guttural sounds emanating as if it was his own private perdition. A chromatic and spherical aberration emanated from the fire and enveloped Larry. Those who had him restrained stood and then helped Larry to his feet. He was no longer fighting, but rather seemed remarkably tranquil, almost hauntingly submissive. Tracy was brooding, staring fixedly at Larry as she approached him with her hands out. She took Larry's pallid face into her hands and shouted imperiously, "It is said. It is done." Larry collapsed as a dead man. I was agitated, full of malice toward my neighbor. Tracy turned her vindictive eyes directly toward our bedroom window as if she knew we were there. Coincidentally or not, Katie and I ducked down out of sight. "You think she saw us?" Katie's heart became rapid, her respiration acute with excitement, with impending dread looming. I could give no explanation for what we had been privy to.
"I'm not sure,"
we whispered between us, building up the courage to rise up to the window again. The blood came back into Katie's complexion and her breathing returned to normal. I raised to take a careful peek out of the window to make sure we were not about to get unhappy visitors. Next door, the fire was gone. Latent darkness had snuffed out any vision. The following day, after a restless sleep and strange, unexplainable dreams, I ventured out into our backyard, acting as if I was checking on my pear trees, all the while taking furtive glances into Wayne and Tressie's backyard, where the eldritch ceremony had occurred. I was sure I was being surreptitious, but then I heard an unfamiliar, friendly voice. My snooping must have been found out. I turned to see Larry standing there on the property line. Are you checking on your pairs? I could do nothing. I had no weapon, and he was much larger than me. I thought of all the horrible ways I could die at his enormous prison hands. He could strangle me to death with former inmate strength, which would take a bit of time. He could just beat me to death straight down into the dirt, like a newbie in a prison yard. Instead of running for the house, I simply answered, "Yes, they're almost ripe enough for preserves." I enjoyed canning and making pear preserves. I did not like making small talk with people I deemed lunatics. I guess you heard all the excitement last night. Larry's question was laughable, if not disingenuous. I thought, how absurd a question. Then I answered my head, and I wanted to say, "Yes, I saw your twisted, Satan-worshipping theater group with all the ludicrous displays of insanity. Yes, I saw you running like a big coward from the warlocks and witches. How could I have missed such an outlandish spectacle?" I could not read this man. He was unclear of his intention. Instead, I actually said, "No, we did not. Was there something going on?" I said dumbly. "We had a few people over for a celebration of my release from the penitentiary, and it was my birthday. We had a bonfire and some singing," Larry said, seeming to be purposely leaving out the part where he was running for his life, and then being held down and forced to eat raw meat. "Happy birthday," I said. I knew nothing else to say. I was not interested in a dialogue with this stranger. After all, he was a convicted felon of who knows what. I ended the conversation with, "Well, see you later. I better check on my trees." Sunday came again, and the bell was rung, so we got up earlier than we wanted to and had breakfast. It was not acceptable or suitable, but from what we knew, we needed to remain sedate and watchful, and we turned to praying for peace of mind. As part of that peace of mind, and to ensure our privacy and secure our yard, I contracted a fencing company that put up a 6-foot fence around the perimeter of our yard, assuring us that our two young sons, Nathan and William, would not be directly exposed to the despicable behavior of the samples. Tragically, I did hear the bleating of a goat, only to not hear it a week later, which led me to mournful conclusions. But then again, I cannot save every goat in the world from tragedy. I continued getting updates from Emily. We had no further contact with the samplers, and the real kicker was, days later, a police raid stormed a different neighbor's house just on the other side of the samples, and two young men were arrested for trafficking illegal substances. 2 weeks after that, our neighbor on the other side of our property was arrested as a suspect in a serial killer case. Maybe the samples were nutcases. But while Katie and I focused on them, it seems even more evil were festering that we never knew. The neighborhood has gone to hell. Today I called a realtor. We knew when enough was enough. I hope you enjoyed The Neighborhood is Going to Hell by Dale Thompson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before you go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, well, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014, 10 years already. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name, and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?